I often wonder why we're still the only ones flying out there. And the focus we have is on, as an airline, we're going to survive.
Pan Air pulls out of the air taxi business in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, no permits, no problem. Shell sends ships to the Arctic.
This is what planning for success looks like, and this is what efficiency looks like.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Pan Air has been operating air taxi services around rural Alaska for more than 55 years. In June, they ended their air taxi services out of Dillingham and yesterday announced that all remaining air taxi routes will soon be canceled as well. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports.
Pan Air has announced that they will be transitioning out of the air taxi business entirely beginning this fall. Pan Air plans to phase out the Part 135 flights from Cold Bay, Dutch Harbor, and King Salmon as soon as other air taxi operators can pick up the routes. Missy Anderson is Vice President of Sales and Marketing.
Our intention is actually to stay in all of the locations until there's another viable vendor in the area that can take on that schedule. And once that happens, then we'll pull out. But we don't have any intentions of leaving until there is another provider that can provide that daily scheduled service.
Pan Air began as an air taxi service. In 1955, founder Orrin Siebert started flying a two-seater Taylor craft between Pilot Point and Dillingham. Business expanded from there to over 45 communities. Orrin's son Danny Siebert is the CEO and has been working for the company for almost 40 years.
We're a business that is always looking for ways to improve efficiency and maintain our viability. We started as an air taxi out of Pilot Point, and it has steadily changed over the years, never stayed static, and it's evolved into what it is today.
Siebert says operating in a lot of the small markets no longer makes sense for the company.
I often wonder why we're still the only ones flying out there. When you look at Mark Aaron, Reeve, and Ween, and Northern Consolidated, and Kodiak Western, and all, I could name probably 40 different carriers. And the focus we have is on, as an airline, we're going to survive.
He cites postal rates, competition, and the high cost of doing business in rural Alaska as some of the reasons for the change. Right now, he says there are no plans to alter Pan Air's Part 121 service that connects major hubs like King Salmon, Dillingham, and Anchorage. But Siebert says any change that will keep the company viable is possible.
I've been working with Pan Air now for almost 40 years, and there isn't a single year that we haven't had changes, some big, some small, and we are always going to be changing and evolving. So yes, there will be changes always.
Siebert stresses that no areas will be left without service, and Pan Air will see that all current and future bookings are honored on their service or another carrier.
If you book on Pan Air, and then Pan Air decides not to serve that community after you bought your ticket, I would ensure that if there was another carrier in the market, that they would honor my ticket.
There's no timeline for the transition, though it's likely to begin soon. Pan Air will have to coordinate with other carriers to ensure that DOT and U.S. Postal Service requirements are met in rural locations. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Opponents of Measure 2 on this month's Alaska primary ballot are using their sizable financial advantage to flood the airwaves. Thanks largely to donations from resource development groups and companies, the Vote No on 2 campaign is running TV and radio commercials in addition to print advertising, encouraging voters to say no to the measure restoring Alaska's coastal management program. Backers of the Citizens Initiative say they're not trying to compete with a full-on media blitz, but believe their support in coastal communities will help them prevail. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
If you're watching the Olympics on TV this week, chances are you've seen an ad like this one, urging you to vote no on ballot Measure 2.
Promoters of Measure 2 want you to approve a complex new law that threatens businesses and property owners. They want
the Vote No on 2 campaign paid for the TV spots with some of the nearly $719,000 in cash it raised since forming just 2 months ago. Mike Satry is executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers, a trade group representing large-scale mines and mining projects in the state. It was one of the first groups to give money to NoOn2, cutting a $25,000 check in June. Satri says the council's membership supported the state's previous coastal management program, but is concerned about the version outlined in Measure 2.
We had some long conversations about where we sat on this program and ultimately decided that because of the uncertainty that this initiative would bring about, the new bureaucracy would bring about, that we simply couldn't support this initiative.
Other resource development companies and organizations have followed suit. That includes a $150,000 donation from Shell Oil, $120,000 from the Alaska Miners Association, and $75,000 from Hecla Greens Creek Mining Company, Juneau's largest private employer. Satri, who's also donated more than $5,000 of his own staff time as an in-kind contribution, says obviously the money will help get the message out on multiple platforms between now and Election Day on August 28th.
We find that most people around the state don't know what this initiative is. And so it's very, very important that we spend our time and money on educating voters.
In contrast to the Anti-Measure 2 group, initiative sponsors, the Alaska Sea Party, raised just under $64,000 during the last reporting period. Juneau Mayor and Sea Party Chairman Bruce Botello says the group will not be airing TV ads during the Olympics, or at all, for that matter.
Obviously, it's a concern because we will not be able to match the message that people will be exposed to, perhaps saturated with.
Botello says the Sea Party plans to respond with a grassroots campaign, including door-to-door canvassing, phone calls, and speeches to civic groups. In response to industry claims that Measure 2 is too complex and would add another layer of bureaucracy, he says the initiative is really just a framework to set up a coastal management program like the one the state had for more than 30 years. Botello says that includes the fundamental feature of coastal management, one-stop permit review for coastal projects by a single state agency. He argues that's pro-development, especially when the builder is a small company or an individual.
That person or company has an opportunity to have all the regulatory agencies at the table at the same time, walking through issues that may arise, and to make sure that we don't get in the cycle that is actually starting to occur now, which is if the permit has to be modified with one agency, you basically have to run the gauntlet yet again.
In addition, coastal management traditionally gives local communities a greater voice in development decisions happening in their backyards. For that reason, Botello thinks the Sea Party will have an advantage when it comes to support in coastal areas.
In the rural coastal communities, there has been a very strong statement of support for coastal management and for the initiative. They see the importance of having a viable coastal management program and having a community voice.
Indeed, the Sea Party's largest contributor is the North Slope Borough, which has given more than $40,000 since late last year. Other top donors include the Bristol Bay Borough, Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and Anchorage businessman Bob Gillum, a major opponent of the proposed Pebble Mine. Satri says Vote No on 2 supporters are not opposed to local input when it comes to development.
I can see why coastal communities want to get a program back on the table.
But he still thinks the measure goes too far. The Alaska Coastal Management Program shut down in 2011 after multiple failed attempts by the legislature to reauthorize it. If voters okay the initiative, it would likely take about 2 years to get federal approval for a new program. Currently, Alaska is the only coastal state without an authorized coastal management program. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The raging Matanuska River is carving land off its banks fast, and at least 5 homeowners in the Matanuska Susitna Borough are losing ground. On Wednesday, Butte homeowner Josh Shaver put his frame home on a trailer and moved it up his driveway to higher ground to save it from the river. Since then, Shaver has made plans to move the house to another lot he owns on the Little Susitna. One other home in Butte is threatened by rising water despite the 1,000 sandbags placed around it to deflect the water. That home has been evacuated. The borough is in contact with U.S. Geological Survey on the problem. Hydrologist Janet Curran.
Actually, actually, the flow in the river this year is not particularly unusual. In fact, during the cold spell that we many of us noticed in July, the river was actually at some of its lowest levels on the record. So most typically when erosion and flooding happen along the Matanuska, it has more to do with the presence of the channel up against the bank and some of the characteristics of that channel than it does with the overall discharge in the whole river.
Three other homeowners in Sutton are facing similar challenges. One Sutton homeowner is actually dismantling his house to salvage it. Curran says it's not unusual for the river to erode several hundred feet at a particular location, although it's not always predictable where that erosion will happen. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a military convoy commemorates the 70th anniversary of the Alaska Highway.
If you're a collector of a historic military vehicle, the chance to drive the Alaska Highway is just sort of one of the ultimates on your bucket list.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Shell hasn't yet received final permits for its Arctic drilling plans, but as KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, the company is starting to send vessels north anyway.
Two of the company's support vessels, the Ivik and the Fenica, left on Alaska early this week for the Chukchi Sea. The icebreaker Tor Viking is expected to join them in the next few days. Together, the vessels will start prepping the drill site for the Noble Discoverer's arrival, Shell spokesperson Curtis Smith.
This is what planning for success looks like, and this is what efficiency looks like. And these are days, of course, in a shortened season already, that we want to use as efficiently as possible.
Smith says the company is not putting its Chukchi drilling plans on hold while the EPA considers proposed changes to the Noble Discoverer's air permit. Shell said last month it isn't able to meet the requirements of the permit and asked the EPA to make revisions. But Smith says those will take months and that in the meantime, the company is planning to drill anyways. Once Shell actually starts drilling, the EPA could determine the company is out of compliance with its permit and issue fines. The agency wouldn't talk on the record for this story. But the air permits are only one of the company's unresolved problems. Shell's oil spill containment barge, the Arctic Challenger, is still under construction in Bellingham, Washington. Once construction is finished, the barge will need to be inspected and approved by the Coast Guard. Smith thinks that can happen by next week.
And then hopefully in the days to come, given permit approvals, the rest of the fleet can move north as well.
The Department of the Interior has said previously that Shell's final permits are contingent on Coast Guard approval of the containment barge. Shell is also waiting for ice to clear from its Beaufort Sea prospects. National Weather Service ice forecaster Kathleen Cole predicts it will be at least a month before the ice is completely gone.
Well, I don't know how much ice they take, but the ice should be, out of that area, I would say sometime in early September, late August, early September. We still have a lot of ice up there to move.
Cole says that's not unusual for the Beaufort. Shell Smith says the company won't break its way to the drill site.
We have the best information and the best images right now in the world of the ice cover in the Alaskan Arctic. So, of course, we'll watch that closely, and as the ice moves out, we'll take our opportunity to move in.
For the time being, both of Shell's drill ships, along with a handful of support vessels, are still in Unalaska. I'm Stephanie Joyce.
In the last 13 years, more than two dozen schools have permanently closed their doors in rural communities across the state. Most are still sitting empty. The schools had to shut down after villages lost too many school-aged kids to meet state requirements. That's the case for the school in Rampart, which closed in 2000. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it's one of four buildings the state is looking to move, refurbish, or demolish.
Rampart is home to about 10 year-round residents. The village sits on the bank of the Yukon River, about 100 miles northwest of Fairbanks. The old school has been abandoned on state land for a decade. Desiree Anden is a grant writer for the Rampart Village Council. She's working on a proposal that would transfer the land and the school from the state to the village.
I have a few ideas, It could be the new community tribal hall where we can have potlatches and cultural gatherings. It could be a community center. It could be a youth center where we can have computers and printers and internet access. We can have a small store. Currently, there is no store in Rampart at all.
It's far too expensive for the village to buy the building and then move it. The school in Rampart was built in 1982. Andon says the 6,300 square foot structure has definitely seen better days.
Well, it's in pretty bad shape. It's, I guess there is a few fuel spills that have to be cleaned up. There's a few broken windows, yeah. And if we were to refurbish it, we'd have to, you know, completely redo the insulation and a lot of work into it.
Andon says refurbishing the building is cheaper than building something new. Rampart isn't the only abandoned school that's become a state concern.
One of the communities that we have heard from on a fairly regular basis is the community of Tetutuliac.
That's Sam Keto. He's the school facilities engineer for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
They have a new school. Their old school was accessed, and the state of Alaska has become the owner of the facility. The community is concerned about the facility being an attractive nuisance, I guess, for people in the community. They're worried about the potential of fire in the building that might impact other buildings nearby.
Aside from buildings in Rampart and Tuntutuliak, the state is also looking at ways to dispose of or reuse two other structures in Newtok and Tulida. The state doesn't run or maintain school facilities. When public schools close, the Department of Education does have a process in place to make the buildings available to other state agencies, municipal governments, or nonprofit organizations. Only one other village has requested a land transfer from the state. In 2003, Birch Creek considered the idea but was unsuccessful. Keto says the process of acquiring and repurposing old village schools doesn't have a high success rate.
I think success can be termed relative. There is one location where the facility and the land were transferred to the municipal government, and the municipal government operated the old school as a community building. And that was in Elam. What they've indicated to us is that it is very expensive to operate the building. So it's been marginally successful for them.
The communities of Koyuk and Bettles have also taken responsibility for old school buildings. But in both cases, the doors remain closed. A number of rural schools in Alaska were constructed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the 1950s and 60s. But Keto says he doesn't know of any historic structures. He says as rural communities contract, his department will continue to work with the buildings that are left behind.
So it doesn't seem to be an epidemic or a growing concern. It's just one of those things that I think we're going to have to deal with on an occasional basis as it does occur.
Interested parties have until the end of August to submit proposals for the abandoned school in Rampart. Keto says the state is not seeking monetary compensation, but they are looking to make sure proposals are financially feasible. The state will also compare the cost of site remediation and demolition before making a final decision. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A new satellite dish will allow the University of Alaska Fairbanks to expand its work for NASA. The 11-meter dish on the campus's west ridge will replace an older, smaller one on the roof of the LV building. Alaska Satellite Facility Deputy Director Scott Arco says the upgraded dish will provide the UAF NASA-funded center more transmission capacity.
Really what we're looking at is providing a new antenna that has higher bandwidth, higher capability to get more data to the ground, but also has increased functionality over the one on the LV building. We can actually send commands back to the spacecraft. And so we connect with the projects primarily in the lower 48, and they will send commands up through us, and then we will transmit them to the spacecraft to help them keep track of what's going on with the spacecraft and tell the spacecraft to do things.
ARCO says Fairbanks is the optimal location for the monitoring of polar orbiting satellites, offering an ideal mix of geographic location, infrastructure, and expertise. The Alaska Satellite Facility currently has nearly $9 million in NASA support contracts and employs 55 people on a range of satellite data collection projects. ARCO says the $6 to $7 million capital project will ensure continuation of UAF's 20-year relationship with the space agency.
Now we'll be in a position to support the current generation, to grow our capability there, to be supporting more spacecraft and more users, as well as to support the new generation, which presumably is going to have even more users than that. We continue to see a growth in the usage of satellite-based data, and the more that we can do to be a part of that, I think serves us well and serves the university well.
The new dish is going up next to a similar large NASA antenna near the UAF ski hut. ARCO says the project will require tree clearing and impact a trail.
As part of the installation of this new system, we're helping to get that trail rerouted, as well as we're going to help build a ski training area for the ski team and for the UAF outdoor recreation. It's going to be a large, flat area. It's going to be about 300 yards long, probably about 50 feet wide, that'll be cleared of trees and flattened.
The satellite project, which gets underway this week, is scheduled to be completed sometime next spring. ARCO says the old dish will remain on top of the LV building, but its future use is unclear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Nearly 2 years after the death of Senator Ted Stevens, a Senate panel has recommended that a Navy warship be named in his honor. Stevens' legacy has already been memorialized through having a mountain named after him in Alaska, as well as the now annual Ted Stevens Day. But several senators today said it would be particularly fitting for a warship to be named for Stevens, given his own military time service and his strong support for military men and women during his 40 years in the Senate. Around 200 participants associated with the Military Vehicle Preservation Association will be kicking off a drive up the Alaska Highway on Saturday to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the highway's construction. Wendy Rossum is a logistics and public relations volunteer with the group.
If you're a collector of a historic military vehicle, the chance to drive the Alaska Highway is just sort of one of the ultimates on your bucket list because of all of the history there. You really can't be a collector of a historic military vehicle without knowing what a significant role they played in the building of the highway, and you can't look at a photo of that whole construction project without seeing one of these vehicles.
Rossum says people have come from across the nation, Canada, and as far away as Australia. They will host a big kickoff at Mile Marker Zero in Dawson Creek, B.C. on Friday night and start off early Saturday morning, traveling 4,100 miles over 27 days. The first stop in Alaska will be in Chicken on August 15th. 77 military vehicles are making the trip.
We have 33 that are World War II era, 11 from the Korean War era, 17 Vietnam era vehicles, and 14 from Desert Storm.
Spending weeks on the road in historic vehicles that were built for war efforts, not luxury, could be uncomfortable. Rossum says there's a wide range of restoration and modifications.
We're actually traveling in a 1942 Dodge WC-21, which is sort of like a pickup truck size. And my husband has done all sorts of restoration and upgrades on it. And in fact, I have seat heaters in my Dodge, even though it's an open cab and we have no doors. And it, when it rains, you get wet. And when it's cold, you get cold. But that seat heater is going to help.
Rossum says there are 60 vets on the trip and 46 women with the group. The convoy will end up in Delta Junction on August 21st, where they will display their historic rides at the fairgrounds and take a group photo at the end of the highway marker. Rossum says they anticipate being back in Dawson Creek by August 30th. Pictures are at our website, alaskapublic.org. An Anchorage artist is garnering attention for her unusual installation in New York's Central Park. Paula Peavy's latest work involves a single-engine plane, the kind often seen in the skies above Alaska. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reports.
Crowds gather around, snapping pictures and taking quick cell phone videos of a small six-seat plane somersaulting on an axis in Central Park. The white plane with blue and gray stripes down the sides is held by its wingtips on top of beams and spins forward with a small motor. The continuously rotating installation is appropriately called How I Roll, and is by Anchorage artist Paulo Peavy. How I Roll included an audio tour passerbys could access with their cell phones.
We not only marvel at the beauty of this refined example of modern industrial design, but also at the poetry of its astonishing motion, held serenely aloft in the midst of bustling midtown Manhattan.
The 1977 Piper Sinica plane needed to be modified before it could be suspended. After adjusting the weight distribution, Peavy put a beam through it that travels from wingtip to wingtip without being seen. She says the engine that keeps the plane rotating constantly is small but powerful.
It's rather slow, but when it's such a huge machine, it's pretty fast.
Big installations and unusual settings, like a somersaulting plane in Central Park, aren't unusual for Peavy. In 1997, she turned a tractor trailer on its side in front of a student group exhibit, and in 2003, Peavy placed a donkey in a small boat in the middle of a body of water for a photograph.
I use beautiful things from the world and then do my art with them. My art is usually big, but sometimes it's also small, and every time I do an artwork, I do completely different.
Alaska is Peavy's permanent home, though she was born in Italy and has lived many places across the globe. And though she isn't from Alaska, she feels a deep connection to the land and the culture. 6 years ago, Peavy's husband, a local musician in a band called Culture Brothers, brought her to Anchorage. Karma Lama was born in a Tibetan refugee camp in India, but has been living in Alaska for 2 decades. Peavy says her husband, his music, his love of the native culture, and Alaska's geography give her inspiration.
When I'm in Alaska, between the landscape and the art of my husband, I just get completely satisfied.
How I Roll was recently dissembled after 4 weeks on display in Central Park and is in the process of being shipped back to Anchorage. Peavy is hoping that another city will want to display it. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Jonasson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, and Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Wendy Jonasson reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.